Thank you for listening to Faith Church Podcast, a ministry of Faith Church of the Nazarene in Jacksonville, North Carolina. We now join our service in progress.
Good morning. We're going to get started and do things just a little differently as we get started. Let me tell you a story or two, and then we're going to have some music. The story was that a sick man went into a doctor's office with his wife. The doctor examined the man and ran some tests while his wife waited in the reception area. The doctor came out to talk to the wife, and the doctor, as he came out, the wife could see that the doctor's expression was not probably very good. So the wife began to get very anxious, and she said, "Doctor, is my husband going to be okay?" And the doctor said, "Well, I'm afraid your husband is very ill. He has a rare form of anemia, and if it's left untreated, he'll most certainly die from it. However, there is a cure." She said, "A cure?" He said, "Yes, with proper rest and nutrition, the disease will go into remission, and your husband should live for many more years. But there's some things you've got to do in order for him to go into remission. You need to take your husband home and treat him like a king, fixing 3 home-cooked meals a day, wait on him hand and foot, bringing everything he needs, giving breakfast in bed. Don't let him do anything for himself that you could do for him. If he needs something, take care of it. Give him a back rub in the morning, a full body massage at night. And one more thing, because his immune system is weak, you have to keep your house spotless at all times. Do you have any questions?" And she said, "No, I don't think so." The doctor said, "Well, do you want to break the news to him or shall I?" The wife said, "That's okay, I'll tell him." So she walks into the examination room, and the husband, sensing that something was wrong, said, "It's bad, isn't it? What is it? What have I got?" The wife said, "The doctor said, I'm sorry, you're going to die." Interesting. Interesting response, isn't it? There's a man whose name was Sanborn. He moved into a new house. It was new to him. And he hadn't been there more than a couple days when there was a knock on the door. He went to the door and opened the door, and a man said, "Hi, I'm Fred, and I'm your postal carrier. I just wanted to stop by to introduce myself and welcome you to the neighborhood and find out a little bit about you and what you do for a living." The guy was normal height and looks, nothing really special about him, except that he had a great personality and obvious interest in talking to Mr. Sanborn. In fact, Mr. Sanborn said, "I was a little bit taken back. You know, I've been getting mail all my life. I'd never received this kind of response from anybody, and it impressed me quite a bit." He said, "Well," Mr. Sanborn said, "well, I'm a professional speaker, and I don't have a real job." And Fred kind of laughed with him, but said, "Well, that probably means you travel a lot. Are you out of town a lot?" He said, "Yeah, I'm away on speaking engagements probably 150 to 200 days out of the year." And so Fred said, "Well, in that case, if you want to, give me your schedule, and I'll hold your mail while you're away, and then have it bundled up for you and ready to give to you when you get back home." He said, "That way, people won't see that mail's piling up, and robbers take advantage of that to come in and steal, break into your house while you're gone." And Mr. Sanborn said, "Well, you know, you don't really need to do that. Why not just leave the mail in the box on the side of the house there in the front wall, and I'll just pick it up when I get back." He said, "Well, you know, if it starts piling up," but Fred said, "I'll tell you what I will do. If the box gets full, I'll just put it inside between the screen door and your front door, and that way if nobody will see it, and that way, but it'll still be available to you right when you come home." And he said, "Well, yeah, that sounds good." He said, "Well, here's what I suggest. If it gets full, then I'll bundle that up and I'll have it ready for you when you get back." He said, "Okay, that'll be fine." Well, at this point, Mr. Sanborn was like, "Wow, this is really amazing. Does our community here have its own private postal service, or is this, you know, a regular postal carrier?" And he said, well, he agreed to Fred's suggestions. Well, he'd been away for a couple weeks later. He was away from home, and he came back home. And he noticed when he went up to the door that his doormat was missing. He thought, "Well, that's unusual." He kind of looked around, and over down on the along the porch there, he saw his doormat kind of bundled up over there. He went over and moved the mat, and there was a package underneath it. And he got to look, and he finally found a note in his other mail from from Fred, who said he had been delivering mail down the street on his normal rounds, and he noticed a box on a neighbor's porch. But the box on the porch, delivered by UPS, was addressed to Mr. Sanborn, four or five houses down the street. UPS had delivered the box to the wrong house. So Fred, the postal carrier, took UPS's box and re-delivered it to the correct address. He didn't want it to be visible to people come by and pick it up, so he took his mat, the mat, and covered it and kind of put it over to the side just so that nobody would notice it. Wow. Fred not only took interest in his own customers, so to speak, but he ended up doing UPS's job for him. Fred got some credit from Mr. Sanborn about that. In fact, Mr. Sanborn is not only a speaker, but an author, and he wrote a book that you can find called
The Fred Factor.
Because he saw a guy who was willing to serve others and make their interest his own. Jesus said, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." For the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So, who do you think most accurately reflected the attitude of Jesus in the two stories that I've shared this morning? The wife who said to the husband, "I'm sorry, the doctor said you're going to die." Or Fred who said, "It doesn't matter who delivered the package, I want to make sure it gets to my friend." What kind of attitude do we have today? I want you to be thinking about that this morning. Do I have the attitude of Jesus who came to serve, or someone who comes to be served? Think about that as we go through the service this morning. It's good to have you here. Would you stand?
Jesus made it clear that he had come not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And Jesus not only proclaimed that and said, "This is the way that I'm choosing to come into this world. This is the attitude, the approach with which I'm coming." But he also demonstrated it in a number of ways, and he illustrated it in a number of ways to challenge his disciples about the way they looked at things. We mentioned the verse, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." And in the context of that verse, he was saying that the folks around you, they are looking to be the top dog. They're wanting other folks to look up to them. They're wanting to be in control. They're lording it over others. But he said, "I didn't come like that. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve." And so you see Jesus choosing to respond in ways that put serving others ahead of himself. Let's look at another passage that illustrates that, from John chapter 13, beginning with verse 1. "Just before the Passover feast, Jesus knew that the time had come to leave this world to go to the Father. Having loved his dear companions, he continued to love them right to the end. It was supper time. The devil by now had Judas, son of Simon Iscariot, firmly in his grip, all set for the betrayal. Jesus knew that the Father had put him in complete charge of everything, that he came from God and was on his way back to God. So he got up from the supper table, set aside his robe, and put on an apron. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the feet of the disciples, drying them with his apron." Now, picture this in your mind. The disciples seated at a table, or reclining at a table as the custom was, and Jesus gets up, takes off his outer robe, puts on a cloak, or some translations listed as a towel, and goes and begins to wash the feet of his disciples. Now, if we were sitting down to supper together, and someone in our group got up and began doing this, you would think they were crazy. Right? You would, "What on earth are you doing?" We don't understand the custom, because we're not living in Palestine in the first century. So, first of all, the question is, what on earth is going on here? Why is Jesus doing this? Well, try to imagine yourself living in first century Jerusalem. For one thing, we would be probably wearing sandals. Now, some folks here this morning are wearing sandals, and that's great. But at that time, everybody wore sandals, and they walked everywhere they went. Can you put two and two together? You spent all day walking around unpaved streets with sandals on. What would your feet be like? Dirty, sandy, sore, but also, remember, you're thinking in terms of Western conveniences. You're thinking of a dusty road, you're thinking of a dirty road, you're thinking of a little path, you know. What you're not thinking about is in Jerusalem at that time, they did not have, what's a nice way to say it, sanitary sewers. They didn't have pipes underground and drains to put all that nastiness down under the ground somewhere in these pipes that are out of sight, out of mind, and away from your nose and your feet. You see, in first century Jerusalem, when they wanted to get rid of dirt, filth, dishwater, they just dumped it out the front door into the street. In fact, it kind of just ran down the middle of the street. In fact, there are excavations of ancient Near Eastern cities where you saw this little trench down the middle of the street. And all that waste just kind of funnels out underneath the city gate wall and down over the hill. So when you went walking down the street to go to your friend's house for dinner, when you got to your friend's house, your feet might be dusty, your feet might be dirty, your feet might be muddy, and your feet might be covered with, well, you fill in the blank there. You understand what we're talking about. Because you've basically been walking to their house through what they used as a sewer, to be frank. So, here you go, you come up to your friend's house, I'm ready to sit down and eat. And the custom was to say, well, not quite so fast. Here, let's call one of the servants over and they'll wash your feet as you come into the house. So, usually one of the youngest of the servants who got the dirty job, right, he would be called and he would then have a basin and a towel and they would, you know, take the sandals off, wash the feet, dry their feet so they could go in clean into the house and get ready for the meal. Now, that's a nice service offered to your guest, right? Well, Jesus and his disciples, they're kind of putting on this this meal, and Jesus had delegated responsibility for the meal to a couple of his disciples. But when it came to the point of organizing someone to provide for the cleanliness of the feet of the guests, can you imagine what happens? You see, just, you remember the attitude of the disciples? You remember at that one point in the Gospels where the story was that the disciples, these folks that would become known as the apostles, are arguing with each other over who is the most important one in the group. Who's got the number one place? Who's got the highest rank among these 12 disciples? And they were arguing over who had the highest rank. No, I'm in charge. No, I'm in charge. No, you're not in charge. I was here first. I'm in charge. You see this argument going on. In fact, Jesus noticed this. Of course, he knew what they were thinking. He just happened to imagine that he didn't know what was going on. He said, what are you guys talking about? Kind of got called on the carpet a little bit. Okay, these are the guys that are arguing over who's most important. So when they get down to organizing this meal, and they're going to be the only ones there, all right, whose job is it to wash the feet? You can see, James and John, brothers, I'm not going to do it. You do it. I'm not going to do it. You do it. And all the rest of them said the same. It's not my job. I'm too important to take that position. I'm not going to act like the lowest servant, the guy that gets the dirty job, because I've got higher rank than that. Right? Can you see that in your mind's eye? These guys that wanted to be next to Jesus, they wanted the place right beside the rabbi. I'm not going to do that. I won't lower myself to do that kind of job. And so they sit down for the meal, And Jesus recognizes what's going on. These guys are so focused on what's in it for me and how is this going to make me look that not one of them will lower themselves, not one of them will stoop to wash anybody else's feet. What do you do with a bunch of guys like that? Jesus stands up, takes off his outer cloak, takes the towel or the apron, wraps it around himself, and begins to wash the disciples' feet. Can you imagine the reaction? Well, we can read about it. When he got to Simon Peter, Peter said, "Master, you wash my feet?" Jesus answered, "You don't understand now what I'm doing, but it will be clear enough to you later." Peter persisted, "You're not going to wash my feet ever." Jesus said, "If I don't wash you, you can't be part of what I'm doing." "Master," said Peter, "not only my feet, then wash my hands, wash my head." Jesus said, "If you've had a bath in the morning, you need your feet washed. You only need your feet washed now, and you're clean from head to toe. My concern, you understand, is holiness, not hygiene. So now you're clean, but not every one of you." He knew who was betraying him. That's why he said, "Not every one of you." So you see, after he had finished washing their feet, he took his robe, put it back on, and went back to his place at the table. Peter said, "Now wait a minute. If I let Jesus wash my feet, I'm kind of saying, the rabbi, he's taken the place of the lowest servant, and after all, the student, the learner, the disciple, has to be willing to follow the rabbi. If Jesus washes Peter's feet, then Peter has to wash the feet of all the rest of them, too. Wait a minute, Lord, you're not supposed to do that. I'm not going to let you wash my feet. That's not your place. You're not supposed to do that." Back of his mind, perhaps he's thinking, "If I let Jesus wash my feet, then I've got to wash anybody's feet. If my Lord and Master washes my feet, then I should have to be willing to serve anybody. If he will lower himself like that, then I can't say that I can't." So he says, no. But Jesus says, "If you want to be a part of what I'm about, this is what it's going to take. Be willing to lower yourself in your own self-esteem and say, I'm willing to serve others just like Jesus served me." Wow. What a challenge that is. Instead of saying, "No, that's beneath me. I'm not willing to do that. Even if it means helping someone else, serving someone else, inconveniencing yourself." Jesus challenges his disciples here to be willing to serve others as he was willing to serve. They were thinking about who's the greatest. They were thinking about the glory that comes from following Jesus, the Messiah, the Master. They were thinking about how he would be able to set them up as prime minister and, you know, the head of the Department of Defense, you know. They were looking for the vice president slot, or vice king, whatever they would call it. They were wanting to be in the positions of leadership, and Jesus says, no, if you want to be great in my kingdom, you have to be willing to be the servant of all. Jesus says we're called to love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love our neighbor as ourselves. What does it mean to love your neighbor as yourself? Well, in the novel, The Brothers Karamazov, the author Dostoevsky wrote about a wealthy and a proud woman who said that she dreams of giving away her money to the poor and serving them as a nurse. And to this comment, the elder Zosima replies, "Love in action is a harsh and dreadful thing compared to love in dreams."
how often it is that we dream of what it means to love our neighbor as ourselves. And we think about how beautiful and wonderful it's going to be. And yet sometimes it's difficult and hard and dirty and sweaty. And it's a challenge. The Apostle John apparently learned the lesson because years later he wrote to his disciples, "Dear children, let us not love with words or tongue, but with actions and in truth." Yes, true love in action can be hard and difficult because it crucifies our selfishness. But it also changes the one who's willing to love and to serve. And it changes the one who is served. The challenge for us is to be willing to live out the words of John the Apostle, who says we're supposed to love in actions and in truth. To love with deeds, not just words. What might that look like if we as Christians were willing to say there's no task in serving and loving others that I'm too good to do? There's nothing that God would call me to do that is beneath me. God, I'm willing to do whatever it is you call me to do to show your love for those around me, to show love for everyone around me, because you love them and you are willing to go to the cross. Jesus didn't say, "No, I love them, but I'm not willing to go there." Instead, Jesus says, "Not my will, but your will be done." It's interesting, Jesus admits that he didn't want to go to the cross. "Let this cup pass from me," remember he said. But he also said, "Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done." What is it that God is calling you to do that may involve serving others? It may not be easy, but it calls you to show the love of Christ to people in need. The story is told that everyone at the State University knew that Donner Hall had the best parties. All-night dancing and beer guzzling attracted the largest weekend crowds. Especially notorious was the second floor and their parties. By midnight every Friday and Saturday, the entire second floor was inches deep in smashed beer cans, bottles, and even stale potato chips, as you might imagine. But about 7 a.m. the next morning, as folks began to get up, and finally, later in the day as well, noticed that all of that garbage was gone. The residents of the second floor assumed that the conscientious janitors of the school would come in bright and early before anybody woke up to clean up the mess. But early one Saturday morning, one of the residents, Chris, still hungover from Friday night's party, stumbled out of bed because he had to head down the hall to the bathroom. Noticing a freshly cleaned floor, he mumbled to himself, "Well, I guess the janitors got up early this morning." But getting to the bathroom, he realized, because of a certain odor that came out of the bathroom, that the mess wasn't completely cleaned up, but the trail of vomit only went so far and ended at a mop. And there, holding the other end of the mop, was Marco, one of the other students who lived on the hall. "Marco, what are you doing?" Chris said. Marco said, "Well, just trying to clean up." He said, "Well, why are you doing that? You weren't even at the party last night. Why would you be cleaning up?" Marco said, "Well, because it's what I think Jesus would do." You see, everybody thought it was the janitor cleaning up. All the time it was Marco trying to serve others as Jesus did. What would it look like if we were to love others as Jesus did? During the opening days of World War II, a large British military force on the European continent along with some English citizens and diplomats, retreated to the French coastal city of Dunkirk. The German army was advancing with an attempt to try to destroy the British force before they could get evacuated across the English Channel. To save what he could of his army, Winston Churchill called up all of the available sea vessels, large or small, and sent them across the English Channel to evacuate the soldiers and civilians from the besieged French beaches and bring them back across the English Channel to safety. So an incredible array of ships and boats raced to the rescue, to rescue the British forces from the shores of France. Fishing boats, cruise ships alike. As the flotilla made its way across the English Channel to stop at the French coast to pick up soldiers and move out again, Nazi aircraft were sent up by the Germans to attack the ships. They strafed them, and the artillery tried to pummel the ships with shells. Ships were, some of them were hit many times. Some were actually blown out of the water. It was told that three British Messerschmitt aircraft attacked a defenseless ship, a cruiser, the RMS Lancastre, a converted cruise liner. Its decks and hold were packed with soldiers trying to get them back to England in safety. However, one of the planes dropped a bomb that dropped directly down the ship's smokestack, tearing a huge hole in its lower hull. Nearly 200 men were trapped in the forward hold of the now severely listing ship. No one doubted that the ship was going down. In the chaos, the smoke, oil, fire, and blood, mixing with terrified cries of the men that were trying to get off the ship as well as those trapped below in the hold. On deck, it was just pandemonium as those who were trying to be rescued looked for lifeboats or simply just jumped in the water. In the midst of all the confusion, the story is reported that a young Navy chaplain quickly made his way to the edge of the hold where the men were trapped below. And then, knowing that he would likely never get out, lowered himself in. Survivors of the sinking of the Lancastria told that the only thing that gave them courage to survive until the passing ships could rescue them was hearing strong, brave voices of men in the hold singing hymns as the ship finally rolled over and went to the bottom. The Navy chaplain chose to give his life with those others because he felt that's what Jesus would do. Then Jesus said, "Do you understand what I have done to you? You address me as teacher and master, and rightly so. That is what I am. So if I, the master and teacher, washed your feet, you must now wash each other's feet. I have laid down a pattern for you. What I've done, you do. I'm only pointing out the obvious. A servant is not ranked above his master. An employee doesn't give orders to the employer. If you understand what I'm telling you, act like it and live a blessed life." Jesus says, "What I've done, you do. What I've done, you need to do." Ask the Lord today, where do I see in my life? Where are you showing me in my life a chance to serve, a way to sacrifice? Because when we choose to follow His footsteps, when we choose to serve and to give and to sacrifice as Jesus did, the promise is that our life will be blessed by God. Our life will be blessed by God. Think about it. What is it that Jesus would have you do to serve others as Jesus did? Where do you see people around you in need? It may not be their feet that are covered in the junk of the world. Where do you see people around you that are hurting, that are helpless, that need hope? What would Jesus have you do? The story comes back to mind of a video that Focus on the Family produced now years ago with the title of Man Called Norman. Anybody remember seeing that? It's been a long time since it's been published. But it was basically a story of a guy who realized that the Lord was challenging him to help the guy named Norman that lived across the street. Norman wasn't quite right. There was something quite not right upstairs. And everybody in the neighborhood was kind of leery of him, and maybe some of them even scared of him. But one day, the gentleman saw Norman across the street trying to mow his grass. And the problem was, Norman was trying to start the mower, and he couldn't get the mower started. He would pull and pull on the rope, and it just wouldn't start. Norman pulled and pulled, it wouldn't start, and so he ran to the edge of his yard, and just, like, looking over toward his neighbor, and just yelled, "Ah!" You know. And this guy across the street thought, what on earth is wrong with Norman? He thought he was going to race across the street and attack him. But he went back to his mower and tried to start it again. It wouldn't start. He ran back to the edge of his yard and just hollered and screamed. Ah! Finally, the neighbor thought, you know, he's having trouble with his mower. I don't know if I can fix it or not, but let me see if I can go help him. So he went over and said, "Hey, Norman, what's going on?" And Norman just kind of mumbled. He couldn't really even understand what he was saying. And he said, "Well, can I help you get the mower started?" And he kind of mumbled at him. Well, the guy said, "Well, let me take a look at it." He got down and started fiddling with the mower, and he said, "Honestly, I don't know what I did. I'm not that mechanically minded," but he said, "Whatever I did must have worked because we pulled on and it cranked it up." And Norman, "Whoa, you know, thank you." They just took off mowing the grass. But that little episode just kind of opened the door for this guy to minister to Norman. And after a while, he began to realize that Norman had some challenges and he wasn't able to take care of his home very well, and there was a problem with Norman's toilet. And this guy told Lord, "I don't want to do it. I don't want to work on Norman's toilet. I don't want to do it." But the Lord told him he had to work on Norman's toilet. So eventually, he said, it's probably one of those things where he had just to get God to quit telling him about it. He said, "Okay, Norman, I'm going to come over and work on your toilet." So he goes over and he said, unfortunately, Norman didn't really clean things like it ought to be cleaned. And he said, "The only way to work on a toilet is to hug it." He said, there's no other way to get your arms around it to work on it. And he said, it was a challenge. But he said he felt like if the Lord was willing to wash the feet of his disciples, he was asking him to hug Norman's toilet, to get it fixed, to serve Norman as Christ had served him. Who is the Norman in your life? Maybe nobody else around you even wants to give them the time of day. Because maybe they're just a little odd or strange, or they don't know quite how to relate to people around them in a normal, quote-unquote, way. Or maybe there's somebody that's lonely and by themselves. They need somebody to come alongside them and share the love of Christ with them and to give them hope in the midst of their darkness. Jesus said, "What I've done, you do." What does that mean for you? Who is the person he's calling you to serve? How is it that you could get involved in helping someone else? There's lots of ways that we as a church try to encourage folks to do that. We talked last week about crisis care kits to help people who are in need out in Asia with the earthquakes and typhoons and tsunamis. There are people that have lost their homes, have lost church buildings. There are things that we can do to help serve others who are in need. We have child sponsorship opportunities where you help provide a hot meal and education for a child who otherwise would not enjoy those benefits. Those are ways that you can get involved on a kind of an international level. But for some people, that's not personal enough. for many of us, there are certainly personal needs around us every day. Who is it that God is bringing into your pathway that He's calling for you to serve, to wash their feet? If not literally, then figuratively, who is it that God is calling you to serve? Because Jesus says, what I've done, you do. But Jesus says an even more amazing thing than that. He says, whenever you do it for the least of these, you've done it unto me. We're talking about connecting with God. And this morning our theme is connecting with God in service. The point is that when we do something to serve Christ, serving someone in need, we are actually serving Jesus. When you go and help your neighbor when their car won't start, you've helped that individual, yes, but you've also started Jesus' car. That sounds like a strange idea, doesn't it? But Jesus says, whatever you've done for the least of these, you've done it for me. When someone you know needs an encouraging word and you send them a card, you've written it to that person, yes, but you've also sent Jesus a card as well. Whatever you've done for the least of these, you've done it unto me. When someone you know is sick and they need, what was it, the lady down in South Carolina, Sue Coburn used to do, she would bring over homemade soup, soup in a can. Said, you open it up, heat it up, and it'll be homemade soup. She served someone who was in need, and when she did that, she served Jesus. Some homemade soup. Who is it that you know that needs you to care for them? When you do that, you do it for Jesus too. Jesus says, what I've done, now you go do. This morning, I don't think we're going to close with an altar call because, yes, it's important for us to pray. It's important for us to draw near to God. But I think what I need us to do today is to say, Jesus hopefully has shown you in your mind a person you're supposed to serve. What we need to do now is to go do that. Make a plan right now. What is it you need to do this week to serve the person that God is showing you needs somebody to come alongside them and love them with the love of Jesus? What can you do this week? Make a plan. Write down on your piece of paper, what is it I can do this week to help someone in need? Put it in your BlackBerry, your Palm Pilot, your phone reminder. What is it that Jesus wants me to do to help someone in need? I'm serious. Make a plan. Oh, you actually mean for us to do something, Pastor, about what you said? Well, yeah, come on. Right? Or is church just a spectator sport? Come on now. Help me out. What is it specifically that Jesus wants you to do this week to help someone who is in need? I'm going to write down what I think I need to do. Are you writing? Go ahead while I finish up mine. You go ahead and do yours. I still have some planning to do on it because I don't know exactly how I'm all going to work it all out, but I have an idea. What's yours? You don't have to tell me right now, but think about it. What I'd like you to do this week is if you actually take action on what God has told you to do, I'd like to hear about it. Send me a Facebook message, an email, phone call, card, letter, whatever means of communication you want to use, even Twitter. You can send me a direct message on Twitter if you want to. B. Crane is my Twitter name. So send it. Just communicate with me. Let me know what it is God told you to do and what happened. What did you do? Okay? Fair enough? All right? Let's stand and go do it. Go ahead. Go do it. Say hi to some people on your way out. God bless you. You're dismissed. Thank you for coming.